I'm C.S. Song, and Peter Linebaugh, L-I-N-E-B-A-U-G-H, joins me in our KPFA studios. He's a social historian based at the University of Toledo. His articles have appeared in Counterpunch, New Left Review, and many other publications. And he's written a lot of very interesting books, including the Magna Carta Manifesto. He has written the foreword to a new edition of E.P. Thompson's biography of William Morris. It's called William Morris, Romantic to Revolutionary. And we've been talking mostly about a new pamphlet he's got out entitled Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, Machine Breaking, Romanticism, and the Several Commons of 1811 to 1812. And before we leave this pamphlet, I want to ask you about modern analogs. So we have some machines back in the early 19th century, which, as you've pointed out, constitute attacks on workers, attacks on communities, attacks on the commons. In what machines or technology currently do you see analogs in terms of their socioeconomic impact?
Well, this is something that I think every listener will have an answer to.
No doubt.
Yes, but the one that leaps to mind and gave the whole world a jolt was the Fukushima disaster in Japan and the utter unpreparedness of the Japanese state, the Japanese energy conglomerates to deal with it, and the popular response, very often led by mothers and housewives, to discover the extent of the contamination and poisoning of the earth and waters and perhaps sky in different parts of northern Japan. And this is of a people for whom this is not their first disaster with nuclear energy. The people who have suffered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, surely one of the greatest deliberate crimes of human history.
Let's turn now to your book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. It was published by University of California Press. And maybe we could start this way. And actually, there's a lot of connections between that book and the pamphlet we've just been talking about. Your interest in the commons, in liberties, against expropriation, the emphasis placed on forests and communities. But why a book on Magna Carta if, as you acknowledge in your book, Magna Carta has been venerated for eight centuries?
Well, I think the important parts of Magna Carta in recent years have been utterly forgotten, especially the prohibition of torture, especially the right of justice and trial by jury, especially habeas corpus, you know, of not locking people up without giving a reason. These are fundamental parts of the due process of law, itself a phrase from Magna Carta, which we find in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment and in other parts of the U.S. Constitution. So because they had been forgotten in the crisis that led to the invasion of Iraq and the continuing crisis of the American penal system from Guantanamo Bay to Pelican Bay, I felt it, you know, a small way as an English historian to remind people that, look, this Magna Carta has played a big role in human history, has played a very big role in American history, in the history of the abolition of slavery, has played a big role in the formation of the English working class movement, and has played a big role in other parts of the world, from Palestine to Barbados to South Africa to Singapore. It's a part of legal traditions. But I wanted to make this tradition live. And when I went looking, C.S., what I found out utterly astonished me in that this Magna Carta, this big charter of in the Middle Ages, was also accompanied by a little charter, the Charter of the Forest, which spoke about the regulation of the principal energy source of that time, which was wood. So the Charter of the Forest had to do with commoning. It had to do with common people's subsistence. And even Magna Carta refers to the common in Chapter 7 when it talks about the right of estovers for widows.
And what are estovers?
Estovers is access to fuel, and in that case, it's access to wood. This is an era before nuclear energy, before petroleum, before coal, when wood was the principal way that people kept themselves warm, the principal way they cooked their food, was over wood fires. Also, wood was the principal building material. So to have access to wood was to have access to life, access to warmth, also access to health. The woods is a pharmacopoeia, really.
And you refer, in fact, to the kind of long-standing image of women out in the forest picking up twigs, picking up sticks off the commons and using them for subsistence, for getting by.
That's right. That's right. A task of cold and brutal drudgery, hardened to hope, insensible to fear, scarce living pulleys of a dead machine, mere wheels of work and articles of trade. So I'm reading from Shelley again. And then Shelley earlier had described such a woman. Wordsworth had described such a woman. Even George Orwell in 1939 saw some Moroccan woman carrying wood, and he thought they were of a different race entirely. What I conclude from this is that these observations, which come down to us from white men, to speak exactly, is that they don't talk to the women and ask them, by what right or why do you take this wood? What are you going to use it for? And if they did, then there could ensue a discussion about customary takings, about forms of commoning. And all those people, you know, who think, oh, the commons is pie in the sky, or oh, the commons is just dreaming, or oh, the commons is just romanticism, if they actually stopped and talked with commoners, in this case women gathering fuel, they might learn something about the practicality of subsistence and of sharing.
Your book reminds us that the Magna Carta was forced upon a king of England, King John, in a meadow along the Thames in 1215, a long time ago. And it was, you write, the proud product of rebellion. There were barons rebelling against King John, and this was sort of the way that conflict was settled. Now, if that's true, why does this document refer to the commons and to widows' estovers, the rights of women to continued access to the commons?
That's a really good question. And the answer to it, I think, is simple. History is written by the victors. If there's any accomplishment we peasants, we proletarians, we workers, we common people, we slaves, if we've made any victory in the past, the working class will claim that they gave it to us.
So you mean the ruling class?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The ruling class will say they gave it to us. But far from that being the case, if we look at history from below, we will see that the rebellion, the anti-war rebellions during the civil wars of the 13th century was the background to the church and state quarrels, to the quarrel between monarchy and the barons from which Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest resulted.
Your book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, is a fascinating history of Magna Carta, the ideas, the provisions through the course of many centuries in many places around the world. I want to take you to the 17th century, during which you write that the Magna Carta was transformed from a medieval document rarely cited, though frequently confirmed, into a modern constitutional law. Can you tell us a little bit about this development?
I think the principle of it is Edward Cook. He's the main jurist whose Institutes of Law was the foundation for U.S. legal studies through Blackstone and through Washington, Madison, Jefferson, and so on. Edward Cook is the one who transformed medieval privileges into modern rights through Magna Carta. And he was able to put meat and power and force into this transformation because of the levelers, because of John Lilburn and the struggles of the English Revolution of the 1640s, than which there is perhaps no historical episode more important for understanding the expropriation of the commons and the bourgeois republic that was formed.
Right, the levelers being, and you can correct me if I'm mistaken, but this was a popular movement. It stressed people's sovereignty, equal rights, religious tolerance. This was the mid-17th century, correct?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And so in that atmosphere, what you're saying is Cook was, what, profoundly affected, influenced by some of these ideas swirling around?
Well, the other way around, I think. The actions of the levelers were very much, yeah, these ideas were swirling around, and Edward Cook was affected by them, and he also helped to transform them. And then the levelers and others used his ideas to give force and substance to this transformation of Magna Carta into a document of modern liberties, so that it'll be cited in Connecticut, in New York, in Maryland, in the colonies where English people settled.
Peter Linebaugh joins us today on Against the Grain. He's a professor of history at the University of Toledo, and one of his books is The Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberties and Commons for All. It was published by University of California Press. We have a link to that book, as well as to a number of other things by Peter Linebaugh, on our website, againstthegrain.org. My name is C.S. Song. Well, if we move to the U.S., the nascent United States, in fact, the English colonies before the states were formed, Thomas Paine had a certain understanding of the Magna Carta, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Tell us about that and about the degree to which Magna Carta's ideas and principles were incorporated into documents of his and the document of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, Thomas Paine, in February 1776, recommended that the United States, if it was to continue its revolutionary independence war from England, would need to have a Magna Carta of its own. And it was that suggestion that impelled the Continental Congress to ask Thomas Jefferson to draft such a Magna Carta, which, and the result was the Declaration of Independence. That's the simple, direct answer. But Thomas Paine was a Republican. That is, he was an anti-monarchist. And here, to be an anti-monarchist meant that he was against hierarchy at every level of social existence, which he also thought was in Magna Carta, though subsequent historians have not always found it there.
If we can return to the commons, which is one focus of Magna Carta, you argue in this book that to think of the commons as a natural resource, and I know a lot of people who do, right? We think of things that are available to all or should be available to all in the sense of maybe air or water. So to think of the commons as a natural resource is misleading at best and dangerous at worst. Why is that?
Because of alienation. Because human society consists of our mutual labors with each other. Our mutual labors with each other are mediated by products of the earth. And to separate those products and that labor from us is dangerous because, yeah, it's dangerous. I think we express ourselves through this commonality, to use the Luddites term, and that social expression, of which I think the household is the most vivid and the kitchen is the most vivid architectural image to understand the commons and commoning. You know, whether you're baking at home, whether you're helping your mother, whether you're responsible for the salad while someone else is doing the soup, or whether someone is washing up and another's doing the drying. All of this is a place where cooperation and commoning takes place, and we don't separate it from, you know, the lettuce or the lentils or the dishes. And I think we can scale up from that and understand that our family life, our kinship groups, depend on the cooperation of labor, and that labor itself is understood in a concrete ways with the wood or with the different substances and tools that we realize our social humanity. That if we separate ourselves from the world, we begin a process of alienation that results, I think, in insanity.
Commoning as a verb, in other words, commoning as a process, as opposed to perhaps the commons as a thing out there.
Precisely, C.S.
What current movements of commoning most encourage you?
Well, at Zuccotti Park last fall at Occupy Wall Street, quickly people found it necessary to provide security for one another. And a women's safe space was established. People found it necessary to eat, and soon a community kitchen was established. People found it necessary to while away the time, which otherwise was tinted with fear or tension, and music was established. Many people wish to increase their knowledge of their activities of Wall Street and the history of capitalism, and a library was established. So here, for knowledge, security, food, people were developing, were commoning. These, I think, is the most powerful recent examples of commoning. One place in New York where it failed, and I think was a question around the world, or around the nation anyway, around the Occupy movement, was the pee question. That is, where could people go to the bathroom?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure how that was solved in different places.
A vital question indeed. Let me begin wrapping up by asking you a little bit about this new PM Press edition of E.P. Thompson's biography of William Morris. It's entitled William Morris, Romantic to Revolutionary. You wrote the foreword, the introduction to that volume. Of course, William Morris, the iconic 19th century designer and craftsman and scholar and agitator and writer and poet, and E.P. Thompson, the iconic British historian of the working class. What drew Thompson to the writings of Morris? Because obviously this isn't kind of a detached biography. Thompson was very invested in many of Morris's ideas.
Yes, William Morris is the first artist of major reputation to stake his life and energy wholeheartedly, 100%, with a revolutionary working class. And he did this in the opposition to the ruling class or bourgeoisie of England. This is what attracted Thompson to Morris. And I think it's also what can attract us to Morris's art, to Morris's practices. Morris was a great communist, you know, long before the Soviet debacle, long before the Russian Revolution. And Morris lived through factional quarrels with Fabians, with reformists, with socialists, with anarchists, and remained a revolutionary communist to the end of his days. He didn't fall into bitterness, and his imagination, his labors of writing, of poetry, of essays, of speeches, remain a tremendous source that we need very deeply now, because the thing about Morris is that he was green. Not only was he a red in the red revolutionary sense of the working class, but also he was green. He loved the planet. He loved the other creatures, the other forms of life on this earth, and wished to preserve them. And that part of England which where you can still roam about, that part of England which still adheres to some green notions, really owes it to William Morris.
And what did Morris hate about modern civilization? Was it primarily civilization's impact on the green spaces?
The shoddy of it. He thought everything is not built to last. It's all built for profit. He hated shoddy deeply. He thought that every worker should be an artist and every artist should be a worker. And he had a completely different conception of work, of labor, and of the planet. And I really recommend us all, I think we should restudy his great utopian book, News from Nowhere.
So the new edition of E.P. Thompson's book, William Morris, Romantic to Revolutionary, is out from PM Press with a foreword by my guest, Peter Linebaugh. He's a professor of social history at the University of Toledo. We've also been talking about his new pamphlet, Ned Ludd and Queen Mab, and his book, The Magna Carta Manifesto, which won many prizes and is a delight to read, as many of Peter's books are. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.